from Turtle Island to Palestine. Occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome, everyone. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
Congressmember Ramirez, but I wanted to ask you about this latest news. A United Nations inquiry has concluded Israel's committed genocide in Gaza. This is Navi Pillay, who headed the commission.
In our report, the commission found that the Israeli authorities and Israeli security forces committed and are continuing to commit the following underlying acts of genocide against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. One, killing members of the group. Two, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group. Three, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. And four, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group.
Congressmember Delia Ramirez, you have called for, you just recently held a news conference with Mahmoud Khalil and others, calling for an arms embargo against Israel. Explain.
Yeah, well, first of all, Israel is committing a genocide, and I think it's indefensible for anyone to, in this moment, try to make an excuse of what's happening and allowing it to happen under our watch. I have a bill. It's a specific concrete bill that blocks bombs to Israel. It is one of the first bills in its nature where now we have 47 members of Congress who have joined the bill, and it says we are going to withhold weapons. We're not going to allow Donald Trump and Bibi Netanyahu to just easily make a transfer of these weapons that we know have violated international law and killed babies. This afternoon, I will be having a deep discussion with a number of my colleagues, calling for them directly in a meeting, urging them to join this bill immediately and bring it to a committee hearing in armed services in the jurisdiction of the bill.
The Israeli military is escalating its attack on Gaza City in an effort to erase the city and forcibly remove the city's entire population. Over the past 24 hours, Israel killed at least 79 Palestinians, but the toll could be far higher. Much of Gaza has been in a communications blackout since Wednesday. This comes as the heads of more than 20 aid groups have called on world leaders to urgently intervene in Gaza after a UN commission concluded for the first time that Israel is committing genocide. The aid groups wrote, quote, "We are on the precipice of an even deadlier period in Gaza's story if action is not taken. Gaza has been deliberately made uninhabitable," they wrote. Meanwhile, Amnesty International has just released a major report on the state's public institutions and companies that have enabled and profited from Israel's genocide and occupation. Companies named in the report include U.S. military contractors Boeing and Lockheed Martin, the Israeli arms companies Elbit Systems, Rafael Advanced Defense Systems, and Israel Aerospace Industries, the South Korean conglomerate Hyundai, and the U.S. tech company Palantir Technologies.
The Amnesty report is headlined, "Pull the Plug on the Political Economy Enabling Israel's Crimes." To talk about the report and much more, we're joined here in our New York studio by Agnes Callamard, Amnesty International Secretary General. Thank you so much for joining us. What we are seeing in Gaza right now, Israeli troops moving deeper into Gaza City as Israel continues its full-fledged military ground invasion. The Israeli defense minister saying Gaza is burning. International condemnation. Hundreds of thousands of people have been forced to flee the city. What is Amnesty International calling for right now, Agnes?
Well, immediately, a ceasefire. No, what we need is to end the suffering. So anything that can allow for the Palestinians some respite, the mother to be able to feed their kids, the wounded to be taken care of, That must be the priority. It's not a priority for Amnesty. It must be a priority for all those states coming to New York. It must be the priority for anyone in this world with a little bit of conscience, with still a little bit of love for humanity. Please, that must stop. That's the immediate demand.
Of course, and we'll get into the other demands that you list specifically in this report. I mean, we gave an outline of the companies that you've named. In particular, let's talk about the U.S. military companies. You talk about Boeing and Lockheed Martin in particular, which is, as the report says, the, quote, backbone of the Israeli Air Force, which has been used extensively during the bombardment of the occupied Gaza Strip. So if you could talk about the number of companies, military companies in particular, which are, of course, the most immediately destructive, the companies who are involved, and what responses you've received from any of them.
Okay. So I think the first message must be very clear. More than years of unlawful occupation, decades of apartheid, 24 months of genocide. That cannot happen in a vacuum. That cannot happen without the support of many actors, hundreds of actors, thousands of actors, powerful actors that are sustaining an economy grounded, based on international crimes. When it comes to the genocide, we all know that Israel's, you know, bombing, eradication of Gaza has been made possible through weapons manufactured outside Israel, against international law, by the way, including the Genocide Convention. We, in the report that you are mentioning, are naming two of those companies. I want to be very clear. They are illustrative of a global trend. They are illustrative of a global political economy of oppression and of killings. Those two companies are Boeing and are Lockheed Martin. We are also naming three Israeli companies that are at the heart of Israel's military operations. We are naming them because we have the evidence of their contribution to, of their link to, the genocide. Others have named other companies. I want to be very clear. We're just part of a global movement that want to denounce all of these economic complicity that are sustaining the worst possible crimes.
Well, I mean, of the companies that you've named, what's striking in the report, there are many things, but there are very few that have responded to the report, despite the fact that Amnesty is, of course, the biggest human rights organization in the world. One of the Israeli companies, Elbit Systems, responded, one of the few to respond, said that their sales to the government, the Israeli government, were, quote, they were lawfully selling because Israel is a sovereign, unsanctioned government recognized by the international community and that there is, quote, no legal basis for restricting our sales. Is there But is there any company, any response that you've received where they have said that they will at least minimally investigate?
If they are named, no. There are companies that may have been withdrawn from our original list, okay? But if the 15 companies that are named have taken no actions and have committed to no actions that we believe will allow for them not to contribute, profit, link, or to be linked to any of those crimes. Just to highlight again the fact that under international law, there are at least, you know, a large number of provisions which demonstrate that those companies are violating the laws and the state that allows those companies to do so are also violating the law. The Genocide Convention and the obligation to prevent genocide means an obligation not to sell weapons to a state that is likely to commit genocide. There are arms trade treaty that prohibit the sale of weapons when those weapons are known to be used to commit international crimes. There is the Apartheid Convention. There is the international occupation law. We have, in fact, we are celebrating the one-year anniversary, sadly, of a General Assembly resolution last year, which demanded that all governments cease to support Israel's unlawful occupation. And what does that mean? It means that everyone is duty-bound not to recognize the unlawful occupation. And that the duty of non-recognition entails the duty of no trade, the duty of no economic relations, the duty of no political relations that are in relation to the occupation. So on many grounds, range of companies are implicated in sustaining, in prolonged international crimes. The reason why we have issued this report too is that we need to understand this is not a 2 years, this is not just a 1 year problem. We are talking about decades of unlawful occupation, decades of apartheid, and now 24 months of genocide.
I wanted to go to Netanyahu, clearly feeling the pressure, who announced on Tuesday Israel will create an independent arms industry that can withstand international constraints, he said.
Yeah. So we are going to produce an independent arms industry, very powerful, very strong, that can withstand any kind of international political constraints and will provide security for the state of Israel. This is what I envision for the state. It's going to continue to grow, it's going to continue to innovate, and it's going to continue to provide for our security and our prosperity.
So if you can respond to what Prime Minister Netanyahu said and talk more both about the level of support that the Israeli arms industry in particular gets from the United States and how the arms manufacturers here are, some might say, making a killing.
Yeah.
And also what this means to shore up the Israeli arms industry, even beyond the companies that you've named, Elbit, Rafael Advanced Defense Systems, Israel Aerospace Industries.
So the statement from Netanyahu indicates, one, that he has in mind an economy of war. That's what he wants to build. And two, that he wants to build a society predicated on war and on weapons and on everything that is linked to that. So I leave that to the Israeli people to think that through a bit more. Look, an autarky, you know, system, it just silly. It's a political statement. It won't make those Israeli companies legal, their actions lawful, whether or not they are just doing that for the Israeli government or whether they are exporting abroad. It is very clear that the production of weapons that is meant for the commission of international crimes is a crime in itself and by itself. The export of those weapons, those three companies that we are naming, are big exporter. They, you know, I was at the NATO summit a couple of months ago. I mean, the fact that we need to understand that for decades, our defense, our Western defense community, the surveillance community, the IT community has been completely embedded with the Israeli companies. It was very clear at the NATO summit. So those companies are major actors globally. We therefore have the tools, and that's where Netanyahu got afraid, because we do have the tools not only not to export to Israel, which we must do, but we have also the tool to sanction those companies, Israeli companies. This is what we call for. We demand that state and other companies stop purchasing from Erbil and the others. We demand that they divest from those companies. We demand that they are barred from attending anything related to our market. That's because the power of sanction is indeed very, very important. And we the people must make sure that our governments deliver on their obligations.
Well, I mean, there's also the question, which you highlight in the report, of the political, extraordinary political support that has enabled this, as you say, genocide to continue for now almost 2 years. You're here for the 18th session of the UN General Assembly. Mm-hmm. Now, Netanyahu announced earlier this week that he's coming again to the White House for the fourth time, as the U.S. simultaneously earlier this month announced that they're suspending visas for Palestinian passport holders, including the Palestinian officials who were expected to attend the UN General Assembly session.
So first and foremost, let's highlight the fact that the United States is holding all of us hostage of the fact that the General Assembly is taking place in New York. And that, frankly, should be unacceptable to the UN and to all member states of the UN. The U.S. political support to Israel for many years, but particularly for the last 24 months, is what has sustained the genocide. There are other support. Germany is one of them. The EU as an institution, until very recently, that is last week or 2 weeks ago, has failed to take action against Israel. The political support has been there all along. Let's not, however, suggest that behind the good denunciation of some governments, including in the Arab world, there were actions. No. There were no actions. And this is what we are insisting upon. You know, you can denounce as much as you want. If you do not take actions, including economic actions, then your words are empty.
Agnes Callamard, you are here in New York for this 80th session of the UN General Assembly. The theme is Better Together, 80 years and more for peace, development, and human rights. This at the same time that the world is watching this live-streamed assault on an entire population in Gaza. The brutal footage on their phones every day might think the UN is totally useless. What are your thoughts on this and your recommendations for reform of the UN? You even mentioned people are talking about moving the UN out. If they're going to impose who can come to the UN, the countries they like, and who cannot come, why should it even be in New York? But the rules themselves.
Yeah. Look, Amnesty has made a number of recommendations regarding the multilateral system and the UN in particular. We need to insist that the UN is a word that describes many things, political bodies, operational bodies. We know that UN agencies are doing a great deal of important work in Gaza or in Ukraine or in Sudan, and that's what we must sustain. The political system of multilateralism is that we need to protect and we need to transform. That begins with the Security Council. Amnesty International support the notion of an extended participation to the Security Council, but we are insisting that the veto must be addressed, the right of the veto must be addressed. It is paralyzed at the moment. It is unable to deliver what should have been expected in the case of Gaza because of the veto power, as it is unable to deliver on other crises such as in Ukraine. So the political bodies that are at the heart of what was created in 1948, including the Security Council, are unable to perform their role. Why? Because the member states are making it so, because they intend on destroying what is left of the multilateral system. So what I'm hoping for is that, you know, we need to continue because we are there. We have the majority of states in the world that want to protect the multilateral system. You have one state in particular, the United States, that is doing everything in their power to destroy it because it is not serving the U.S. interest. But time and time again over the last 2 years, the international community has said we need a multilateral system. We need laws that bind us together. We need rules. Extraordinarily, the Hague Group
that has been formed to put pressure on the international community's action on Gaza. The Hague groups has also demanded that the International Criminal Court be protected, and there are governments in this Hague group that are no friends of the International Criminal Court, by the way. So everyone is suddenly realizing, wait a minute, we are going to destroy something that at least has protected us from the worst. This is what has been happening for the last 2 years. This is a litmus test for humanity. This is why we're saying, please, humanity must win. And that also includes protecting a little bit of what has been there for the last 8 years and transforming what is not working. International financial institutions need an in-depth reform, which were actually put forward and adopted a year ago during the General Assembly with the Contract for the Future.
Well, I mean, you know, Amnesty is just one of, you mentioned this international, the multilateral system, the international legal framework under which this genocide is occurring. There have been so many reports, findings, decisions concluding that a genocide is occurring in Gaza by many of precisely these institutions, including most recently this UN inquiry, also judicial bodies, the International Court of Justice, the ICC, human rights organizations, Amnesty, which became the first in December, academic organizations, the International Association of Genocide Scholars, humanitarian organizations, medical organizations, Médecins Sans Frontières. Now, we speak to people in Gaza regularly. It's absolutely beyond reason that none of these statements, which they mention, all of these decisions come out, organizations, very powerful ones, make statements, and yet it's going to be next month, it's going to be 2 years that this has been happening. And as you mentioned, these international organizations were born in the wake of the worst genocide in history, or at least in modern history. And they were, you know, responsible for ensuring nothing like this would happen again. Now, of course, it did in Rwanda and Srebrenica and in Cambodia. But in this case, as against all those others, the most powerful countries who were responsible for setting up these institutions are actually backing this genocide, on top of which, as the Irish lawyer who was advising the South African government at the International Court of Justice, as she said, it's the first live-streamed genocide. Yeah. Mm. So, you know, if you could comment on that, what is, in fact, the utility of people making these statements beyond symbolic or rhetorical? And second, what is Resolution 377 at the United Nations, and why has it not been invoked in this case, the one, the Uniting for Peace resolution that enables the General Assembly to make a decision when the Security Council is deadlocked, which would, in fact, go so far as to necessitate, call for peacekeeping forces in a situation precisely like this one?
First question. NGOs don't stop genocide. Doctors don't stop genocide. Human rights investigators don't stop genocide. State stop genocide. Companies can stop genocide. The international civil society for the last 24 months, I think, has played its role. The last one being the Commission of Inquiry. The people of Gaza, the Palestinians' human rights organization, have played their role. They denounce, we denounce, investigate, report, but we cannot stop the genocide. It's not something that we can, you know, that it's not something that we can do. What we can do is highlight the complicity, is highlight the fact that states are failing to do what they should do under international law, and that too we have done. But when you are, what I think what Gaza is showing us is that when the most powerful state, that is the United States and many states in Europe, are prepared to completely vandalize their own commitment and what they championed 80 years ago, when Russia could not care less because they want to do whatever they want to do in Ukraine, and when China is thinking, oh, this is probably nothing good for me, nothing to gain from it, I won't, then it goes on. It goes on and it goes on. And the 80-90% of the global community that has repeatedly demanded ceasefire, an end to the genocide, we are the global majority. We, not in a racial term, not in a ethnic term, we are the global majority. We have demanded an end to the genocide. States, the majority of states, and yet nothing is happening because the most powerful state starting with the United States, is making it impossible. And that resolution that you are mentioning has been used. The problem with the GA resolution is that they are not binding. But yes, it is remarkable that the General Assembly has, on two or three occasions over the last 2 years, taken upon its own, you know, has grown into saying, well, if the Security Council is paralyzed, we won't be paralyzed. And this is when you realize that it is largely 90%. You know, at the last resolution a week ago, it was on the two-state solution. We had a handful of states voting against it. We are the global majority demanding an end to the genocide. So why isn't it happening? Well, it is not happening because that global majority made up of states is not acting. They know they should do, but are they prepared to do the right thing? Are they prepared to divest from Israeli's company? Are they prepared to sanction those that are feeding the genocide? You know, if 80% of the global community was actually acting on their words, I think the genocide will have stopped. So, yes, we are confronting a very powerful enemy of humanity, but sadly, we have not been helped by the fear, by the cowardice, by whatever it is that is currently animating most governments in the Arab world, in Asia, and in Africa. They are not rising to the challenge in terms of actions.
Well, and yes, just, you know, last, you mentioned many European states who are backing Israel. The EU is the largest trading partner of Israel. What would it mean, it's highly unlikely, if this plan to limit trade with Israel were to actually go through, what the EU announced?
I think it may go through, actually. It will have, that's why Netanyahu is talking about creating, you know, an economy, a self-reliant economy. It will have an impact. This is why Amnesty International and others have spent the last 24 months lobbying at the European Union. That has been an absolute shameful 24 months. The president of the EU has made a mockery of any principle upon which the European project has been built. It is not just a market project. It is not just an economic project. It is a value-based project, and she has spitted on it for the last 24 months. So we are continuing to demand that the EU act on its founding text. Act on its principles, and there are states in Europe. I have mentioned, of course, Germany, Hungary, as supporting Israel. But let's not forget the role played by Ireland, the role played by Spain, the role played by Belgium. I mean, here, at least, we have some European states that have spoken loudly and that have acted according to their word.
In a historic move, Britain, Canada, Australia, and Portugal have formally declared their recognition of a Palestinian state Sunday, ahead of the United Nations General Assembly here in New York. This is British Prime Minister Keir Starmer and Australia's Prime Minister Albanese, beginning with Starmer.
I state clearly, as Prime Minister of this great country, that the United Kingdom formally recognizes the state of Palestine.
Effective today, Sunday, the 21st of September 2025, the Commonwealth of Australia recognises the state of Palestine.
France and at least five other countries are expected to also recognize Palestine starting today, joining more than 140 countries who now recognize a Palestinian state. Hussam Zamlat, the Palestinian ambassador to the United Kingdom, spoke on Sunday.
We realize that the recognition itself will not stop the wheels of colonization and theft of land and oppression of our people. But the question is never, why should the UK and the rest of the world recognize the state of Palestine? The question is, why the UK has not recognized the state of Palestine until now? And the answer is where we are today. Because of the lack of this recognition, because of the lack of this foundational step, things have been left to fester all the way to genocide being committed in full view of the world.
Several members of the Israeli government responded to the developments by calling for Israel to annex the occupied West Bank. For more, we're joined by three guests. We begin with Jeremy Corbyn, member of the British Parliament, served as Labour Party leader from 2015 to 2020, recently hosted a Gaza tribunal that accuses the UK of complicity in Gaza genocide. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Thank you for joining us from London. Jeremy Corbyn, can you start off by responding to this historic recognition and what more you'd like to see?
I've just come from an event held outside the Palestine Mission in London, which we now must refer to as the Palestine Embassy, and I'm delighted to be able to do that. And unfortunately, I wasn't able to get back to my office. I'm doing this from a park, hence all the noise in the background. Yes, it is a huge step forward that Britain, after years and years of campaigning and pressure, has finally recognized Palestine and joined the 140 other nations that have done so. But, and this is a huge but, what are we recognizing? A people under occupation, a genocide that's happening in real time in Gaza, and in the case of Britain, a country that maintains strong economic ties to Israel, continues security cooperation, supplying parts for F-35 jets, and allowing RAF bases to be used by Israeli planes as well as RAF planes. But what it does do is gives us the chance and the opportunity in Britain to put renewed demands and political pressure on the British government to end all the arms supplies and impose real economic sanctions against Israel. And in response to this, we're now organizing the biggest ever demonstration in support of Palestine on October the 11th in London, because people are just so angry, unbelievably angry, when they see the images of children being starved to death, doctors crying because they cannot perform operations properly because they've got no antiseptic, anesthetic equipment or anything else. And our Gaza Tribunal, which the Peace and Justice Project held for 2 days, 10 days ago, was devastating in the evidence that we collected of the legal action and of the way in which the Israeli bombing of Gaza is actually planned all around building of the Riviera, which Trump has been dreaming about. And so this is an opportunity to renew our political solidarity. It also actually further isolates the United States in global opinion, because the United States is the only real big country that still supports Israel. And so I think the pressure must be on, and my sympathies and solidarity to all the Palestinian campaigners all across the USA. You can do it, and we're with you, and we'll support you in any way we can to help force the administration change its policy.
Jeremy Corbyn, the UK is recognizing a Palestinian state based on the 1967 borders, which includes the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. How does this recognition impact the legal standing of Israeli settlements in the West Bank?
I think it damages the pretense that the settlements in the West Bank have some kind of legal status in Israeli law. These settlements are actually a form of occupation. They are part of the Greater Israel Plan. What they are is a sort of advance guard for the complete occupation of the entire West Bank. And so they've obviously got to stop and got to go. And I think it makes their position in international law less and less tenable, because Israel will claim it's the occupying power. But the occupying power is bound by the Geneva Convention, the Fourth Geneva Convention, on what they can and cannot do. And Israel is doing everything it cannot do in law. And so international law has been found against Israel on many, many occasions. But unless the rest of the world does something about it, like making sure aid gets in, like making sure the flotilla gets there, like making sure the arms no longer flow, then international law will be brought increasingly into disrepute as a result of this.
We're also joined in Ramallah in the occupied West Bank by Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, Palestinian physician, activist, politician, who serves as general secretary of the Palestinian National Initiative. The initiative said Palestinian recognition, quote, must immediately be accompanied by the imposition of sanctions on Israel to stop the war of extermination, ethnic cleansing, and starvation in the Gaza Strip. Your new essay, Mustafa, in today's New York Times is headlined, Palestinians need more than the gesture of statehood. If you can please respond first to Britain, Canada, Australia, Portugal recognizing a Palestinian state. I think on the Eiffel Tower now are the flags of Palestine and France. And what more you want to see? Oh, Palestine and Israel, Israeli flags are on the Eiffel Tower.
Well, first of all, I want to say that we welcome, of course, the recognition, because it means that there is affirmation of the right of the Palestinian people to have self-determination. These recognitions negate completely the Israeli measures to kill the possibility of a Palestinian state and negate the Israeli discriminatory laws like the state-nation law, which says that the right of self-determination on the historic Palestine is restricted to Israeli Jewish people. It also denies and negates the laws that Israel has passed to prevent the establishment of an independent Palestinian state. That is all good. It's a bit late, maybe not a bit late, but actually too late. But it's not enough either. We think we are now at a stage where nothing will stop Israel, nothing will deter Israel from continuing its genocidal war in Gaza and its bombardment of the Palestinian people there and its collective punishment, including starvation, and its acts of ethnic cleansing, especially now in Gaza City, and also the terrorist settlers' attacks in the West Bank. Nothing will deter all of that except sanctions on Israel immediately. By the way, while we talk, I just received information that the Israeli planes bombarded the main Palestinian Medical Relief Society center in the city of Gaza. Destroyed it with three rockets and destroyed it completely, injuring some of the people who are working there and destroying one of the most important vital health centers in the city of Gaza. So we need sanctions. We need measures. I think the previous speaker spoke about that very clearly. And we need Israel to be restrained by these measures. One last point, which is that it is clear, as you can see now, with 10 more countries recognizing Palestine, which means 152 countries already recognize Palestine, more than 80% of the General Assembly members of the United Nations, much more than countries that recognize Israel, by the way. That puts Israel and the United States of America in very clear status of isolation because of the policies that Israel is following, and because of the unconditional support that Trump's administration is providing to it, even when it is committing such horrible war crimes.
Can you comment on Basil Adra, the director of the Oscar-winning film No Other Land, his home again raided?
Of course, that is totally unacceptable. And that is one other form of oppression, of freedom of expression, and oppression of people's ability to express the case of Palestine. And in my opinion, what we are subjected to is much worse even than what people in South Africa have been subjected to during the apartheid system. Yeah. But as I said before on your program, Amy, and I thank you for hosting me today, as I said before, the story of Palestine is becoming so similar to what happened in South Africa. People change, and then they change the parliaments in their countries, and then the parliaments change their governments. Everything you see in terms of recognition today by France, Britain, Australia, Canada, and others is happening only because of the steadfastness and resilience and resistance of the Palestinian people, because of the heroism of ordinary Palestinian citizens who refused to leave their country and who risked everything to stay in Palestine. And it's also because of the heroism of so many people in these countries, the people of France, the people of Britain, the people of Canada, the people of Australia, and the people of the United States, by the way, who are standing up against injustice and standing up in support of Palestine.
Dr. Barghouti, I wanted to get your response in this final minute to Israel's far-right minister, Bezalel Smotrich, calling the Gaza Strip a real estate bonanza, saying a business plan is on President Trump's table. He's added, we've done the demolition phase. Now we need to build. And of course, this reinforces what President Trump has said. He says the U.S. will take over the Gaza Strip and we'll do a job with it, too. We'll own it. We have 30 seconds on what especially responsibility the U.S. has.
What you say is a reflection of things that can only be said by fascists and by fascism. What the United States must do is to stop this terrible, horrible fascist tendency. Listen to the American people. The American people are changing, and they would not let this administration continue what they are doing.
Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Palestinian physician, activist, politician, serves as General Secretary of the Palestinian National National Initiative, speaking to us from occupied Ramallah.
We turn now to the story of Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, an acclaimed Palestinian pediatrician and director of the Kamal Adwan Hospital in northern Gaza. As the situation around him became increasingly dire over the course of Israel's bombardment, Dr. Abu Safia began recording videos for the world to see what was happening in northern Gaza and to plead for help. This is Dr. Abu Safia on December 22, 2024.
We do not know why we are being bombed, and we do not know why we are being targeted in this way. Despite us asking the world for international protection, we continue to appeal to the world and remind them that there are Geneva Conventions that the world sings praises of. This includes the protection of the healthcare system and the protection of hospital staff. Up until this moment, unfortunately, we are being targeted in full view of the entire world, but unfortunately falling on deaf ears.
When Dr. Abu Safia recorded that video, the Kamal Adwan Hospital was the last functioning hospital in the north of Gaza. Just days later, Israeli forces stormed the medical complex, and the doctor was detained and imprisoned. He remains in Ofer prison to this day without charge or trial. A powerful new film produced by the documentary program Fault Lines on Al Jazeera English tells his story. The film is called The Disappearance of Dr. Abu Safia. We'll be joined by the film's director and a colleague in just a few minutes, but first to the film itself.
They detained him and a few other doctors in the outpatient clinic. They interrogated them.
He was beaten three times in the chest with the butt of a soldier's gun, and by hand, too. He was insulted. He was interrogated about trivial things. Why won't you leave the hospital? Why are you staying in the north?
The situation is catastrophic in every sense of the word.
They told him, Dr. Hussam, don't connect with journalists. They didn't want him to tell the world what was happening in Gaza and in the north.
In the early morning, when the army withdrew from Kamal Adwan Hospital, my father went to check on the hospital and the martyrs. He found my brother Ibrahim among the martyrs.
He collapsed. He was crying for 6 or 7 hours. He didn't stop because he was very, very close to his son Ibrahim.
In the next clip, we hear from Dr. Abu Safia, his wife Albina, and again from his son, who we just heard from, Elias.
They burned our hearts over the hospital. They burned them completely. They killed my son.
because we deliver a humanitarian message.
He was a young man, only 20 years old. He had his whole life ahead of him. He wanted to study medicine and become a doctor like his father. We buried my son next to the hospital, just outside the hospital, and said goodbye to him.
During the burial, my father was called to the ICU and he responded. He left my brother Ibrahim during the funeral. He couldn't even take the time to grieve my brother Ibrahim. He took his tears with him into the operating room. This made him more determined because my father treated all his patients like they were his sons.
The second raid on the Kamal Adwan Hospital occurred on December 27, 2024. In the following clip, nurses Rawiya Tanbura and Abdul Munaim Al-Shrafi describe what happened. We also hear from Dr. Abu Safiya's wife, Albina, describing his arrest and Israeli military personnel issuing orders.
The tanks began to encircle the hospital.
There were so many tanks and vehicles. Me and the guys were joking that they moved all of Israel to us.
Everyone in the hospital, the army surrounds you. You are surrounded.
A big tank entered and stood by reception, and it started firing forward, firing and turning. And then they pointed the muzzle through the reception door, and it was going like this at patients.
I thought it was the last day of my life.
When the army arrived with a tank and a quadcopter, they called him.
Doctor, lift your shirt, doctor, lift your shirt.
He was going to them confident that he had not done anything wrong. He went to them in his white coat.
Come, doctor. Come, doctor. Good morning. How are you? Everything good? Come on in.
The army ordered Dr. Hassan to get all the people out.
You must follow instructions and gather in the central courtyard. Everyone in the hospital. The army surrounds you.
Dr. Hassan got them out under the army's order, under threat.
In the next clip, Kamal Adwan nurse Rawiya Tanbura describes how they were forced to evacuate the hospital. Then we hear from nurse Abdul Munaim Al-Shrafi about how male medical staff, including Dr. Abu Safiya, were treated by the Israeli military.
They evacuated us women, including the female medical staff.
Of course, every time the Israeli soldier speaks to us, he's yelling, "Wait here, you son of a." We followed his orders and stood without a word. We're scared.
We asked them, "What about the men?" They said, "You're going to go and they'll join you after."
There's no one left inside?
No, there's no one left.
The entire hospital?
Yes, the entire hospital.
Since the start of the raid, we suspected Dr. Hussam would be arrested because they had already threatened him.
The army finished what they needed to do, and Dr. Hussam said goodbye to them. As Dr. Hussam was walking away, they called for him, "Hussam, Hussam, come. Tel Aviv wants you." They blindfolded him. They also tied his hands, and then they made him walk. And then they threw him to the ground and started beating him. That happened to all of us. They were treating us like we're terrorists. Their message was, "We are in control of everyone." They kept us in handcuffs. They humiliated and hit us. They covered our faces and told us to walk like this. They removed our clothes. We stayed in our underwear. We were walking in a straight line behind each other, Dr. Hussam at the start, and the medical staff behind him. I could see Dr. Hussam, but I pretended I couldn't see him because I didn't want him to feel deflated. I didn't want to see him like this.
Now to a final clip from the disappearance of Dr. Abu Safiya, including his wife Albina and his attorney Reid Qassem. It begins with footage from Israel's Channel 13, where Dr. Abu Safiya was seen for the first time since his imprisonment.
Sufyan, how are you?
Fine.
You are a doctor of Kamal Adwan, right?
Yes.
Everything that a detainee eats per day does not exceed 1,000 calories.
His weight was around 90 to 95 kilograms. His lawyer told us that he now weighs 60 kilograms. What did they do to him for him to get to this point?
There is a deliberate policy inside prisons to starve people there. They want to make an example out of them. I don't know if the prison administration deals with the detainees like they're truly human beings.
You have seen the hostages, our hostages, Israeli hostages.
What is he saying? Did you see the Israeli hostages?
No.
My work is mainly with children. I'm a pediatrician.
They interrogated the doctor a lot.
Most of the questions that they asked Dr. Hussam in the interrogation were about his work at Kamal Adwan and about the hostages and fighters.
After all the beating, all the torture, and all the interrogation, they still weren't able to pin anything on him.
Even when the intelligence services come to talk to him sometimes, they say, "We have nothing on you, but despite this, you are being held, detained, and we're still interrogating you."
Why are you here?
I don't know. I really don't know.
Excerpts from Al Jazeera's Fault Lines documentary, The Disappearance of Dr. Abu Safia. We go right now to Amel Guttatfi, who is the director of this film. We only have a few minutes. If you can talk about last time the doctor was seen, head of the Kamal Adwan Hospital, particularly known for its care for children, and how it's possible that he has been held without charge, without trial, and what you know of his whereabouts now and his condition.
Of course. Dr. Abu Safia now is in Awfar prison. That is a prison in occupied West Bank. According to Tislam there, there's clearly a policy of torture and beating and abuse at the prison there. He's been held for over 250 days without formal charges and without any due trial. The only person that's been able to visit him is his lawyer, and that's because she's fighting very hard to get those visitations. He has really awful conditions that have been documented by multiple organizations that show you that there is an organized and declared policy of the prison authorities to treat the 2,600 detainees that are inside these prisons poorly.
Well, Dr. Azra Ziada, you were in touch with Dr. Abu Safia every day for months. Your final thoughts, both on the film as well as on his condition now?
So I think the film really exposes and captures the process and the blueprint that Israel uses to attack and decommission hospitals. And I think the film is the most pertinent at this moment in time, because this blueprint is being used right now across Gaza. However, it's not really under the limelight, and it's not as exposed as it was when Dr. Abu Safia was in Kamal Adwan.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Dr. Azra Ziada, we thank you so much. London-based medical doctor, healthcare systems analyst, who's helped gather evidence of war crimes from Gaza and has been in touch with a network of doctors and healthcare workers in Gaza, including Dr. Abu Safia. And thank you so much to Amel Guttatfi, who is the director of this documentary, The Disappearance of Dr. Abu Safia, which is available online.
That's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. To listen to this episode or any previous episode again, you can go to CQUT's website at cqut.ca and click on the name of the show to see the archive. You can also find the link to this archive on CFRC's website at cfrc.ca. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Join CFRC on September 28th at the Broom Factory at 9:30 a.m. for our Airwave YGK Sound Tech Workshop. Rob Bailey of Kingston Soundworks will facilitate this hands-on workshop for young emerging musicians just starting out playing gigs. Come learn soundboard tech, terminology, troubleshooting, communications, equipment setup, and soundcheck basics with this local industry pro. Register now for the free workshop, make in-person connections with local musicians at a prestigious venue, and learn the ropes of sound mixing to help you get started with your live stage performances. The fun starts at 9:30 a.m. on September 28th at Broom Factory and includes a catered lunch from our friends at Old Farm Fine Foods. Register now via